Okay, so we are starting with mitzvah number three. I'm going to share my screen. Here we go. Mitzvah number three, idolatry. Okay, Avodah Zarah, Shituf. Shituf means like partnership, right? The partnership between God and anything else, so to speak. Probably should have put that in like hand quotations. Okay, here's the source pasuk, both for Sefer Chanoch and for Rav Hirsch. We are conveniently, again, have the same source pasuk for e mitzvah. Again, we're going to see that they label it a little bit differently, and that's always fun, and we'll see where it goes. Okay, this is Shmos 23. The first mitzvah, according to Rav Hirsch, was Shmos 22, which was Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Tzivtecha Me'aretz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avadim. Right, this is Lo Yeh Lecha Elohim Acherim Apana. You shall not have no other gods besides me. Rav Hirsch translates that in an interesting way. It's you shall have no other gods on the face of my all-pervading dominion. Mashehu Kazeh. Let me find the actual language of it, which he has a footnote that says this is always the meaning of the word panim. What is it? You shall have you, no nothing else shall be a god to you alongside my omnipresent and all-pervading dominion. Footnote: this is the usual significance of panim as applies to God. So that's always fun. Okay, so here's Sefer Chanoch. Ready? So let's make a prediction. First and second. Okay, before we do any of this, let's make a prediction of what we expect to happen. Okay, is Sefer Chanoch? You can give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And is Sefer Chanoch going to take the classical interpretation of this mitzvah, which seems to be avodah zarah? You should have no other gods besides for God. Right? Sefer Chanoch, we expect, is going to go. Yeah.
I'm going to be back in like 2 minutes. I don't know if you want to talk. Do your
Great.
thing. Do your work.
Okay, there. Great. We'll miss you for 2 minutes. Right, so we expect Carrie. Hi, Carrie. We expect Sefer Chanoch, right? Not if you expect this also, to take the more classic approach to this, right? That he's going to say it's about avodah zarah. You should serve no other idols. You shouldn't serve idols. And then he's going to talk about serving idols and how to serve them. Hi, Bacheva. Hi, Bacheva. Welcome. So nice to see you. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so again, we're doing the mitzvah of idolatry, mitzvah number three, according to Rav Hirsch. It's mitzvah number 26, according to the Sefer Chanoch. Again, we expect, if we're going to make a prediction about reality, we expect that Sefer Chanoch is going to take the more classic approach. This is going to be avodah zarah, as we've always learned it. You shouldn't bow down to idols. Shkoyach, right? My kids know that too. They know that you shouldn't bow down to trees and stones and other things like that. Like, they learn that pretty quick, and they think it's kind of cool to know that about religion. And we expect Rav Hirsch to take, like, a little bit more of a broad approach, right? Something about our world perspective, usually in a way that we, like, kind of didn't expect, and kind of is like, wow, that's actually really profound. I wasn't expecting that. So we shall not be disappointed. Bye, Jeff. Okay, we shall not be disappointed on either account. Okay, so let's go to Sefer Chanoch now, and let's learn him up so that, again, we learn the classic, and we also sow the seeds for being surprised by Rav Hirsch, which is, like, always just a way more fun experience. Okay, here we go. So Sefer Chanoch calls this mitzvah number 26, Shalo na'amin be'eloka be'eloha biladei Hashem levado. You should not believe in a god other than Hashem. So why doesn't he call this mitzvah avodah zarah? Why doesn't he call it like Rav Hirsch does? Just call it avodah zarah. Okay, even more so, right? Last time we did Achdus Hashem, which also Sefer Chanoch called something along the lines of Achdus Hashem. And he said, remember last time, he said this is in the category of avodah zarah. So we see from here that Sefer Chanoch basically, this is my argument, I'm not sure, this is my argument, Sefer Chanoch does not have the luxury of calling this mitzvah avodah zarah. And neither can he call Achdus Hashem avodah zarah. Because Sefer Chanoch, from his Pierce last time, taught us that he thinks in broad categories of mitzvos. So there are many mitzvos, according to the Sefer Chanoch, that fit into the category of avodah zarah. Sefer Chanoch doesn't have the luxury of calling them all avodah zarah. He has to give them all different names that talk about different aspects of them. For example, the next mitzvah in Sefer Chanoch, mitzvah number 27, is, hold on a second, let me pull it out so I get the actual lashon, is shelo la'asos pesel, not to make an avodah zarah. Okay, and last time it was Achdus Hashem, not to believe in Achdus Hashem and not to believe that anything has power other than Hashem, right? So, because Sefer Chanoch has to, so to speak, come up with 613 mitzvot in the Torah. Rav Hirsch and Chorev only has 118. So he can have a mitzvah number three be an entire category of avodah zarah, under which Sefer Chanoch has to include many of the 613, right? He basically has like one, I don't know, I guess one-fifth, one-sixth of the mitzvot that Sefer Chanoch has. So again, I think that's why you see the difference, but let's go into it. Anyways. Okay, ready? Shelo na'amin elo, shelo na'amin belohim. That's interesting. It's a different lashon here. Zula si Hashem yizbarach levado. Shenamar lo yelcha elohim achrim apanai upeirisho lo tamin be'aloha acher zula si. Don't believe in another god other than Hashem. V'chasav haram ban. And here he says something fascinating and awesome. He says, here we go. Lo tzim tzala olam shayomar hakasav elohim achrim rak al ha'amonas halev. Okay. Whenever the pasuk refers to Lo Yelecha Elohim Achirim Al Panai, every time it says Elohim Achirim, it's not talking about what will be the next mitzvah, which is not to make an avodah zarah. it's only ever talking about not to believe in a Vodazara and not to serve a Vodazara. And he says it has to be so. He gives a logical proof. What's the logical proof? Why does it have to be that when the Torah says ever says Elohim Acherim, it's talking about serving gods or believing in gods, and it's not talking about making gods? Okay, this is, I'm pretty sure this was his logic over here. We can read it together. Right? Ki lo tipol b'loshon asiya acherim. Because the word acherim cannot refer to making gods. Because you can't say don't make other gods. Because that implies that you can make a god at all. And you can't make a god at all. So the pasuk would never say don't make other gods. Because that implies that you can make a god. And you can't make a god. So it has to be that whenever the pasuk says other gods, it's only talking about serving other gods, because you can serve one god, don't serve more. Or it's talking about believing in gods, because you can believe in one god, but don't believe in more than one. Okay, so that's just like a fun, interesting like heuristic to use as we learn this, is that every time we see the words Elohim Acherim, it has to be talking about belief structures and service. Okay, so then he goes basically a little bit more into it. We're mostly going to skip this. V'zoza mitzvah hi'ikar gadol shebetorah. Right, this is very important, which is exactly what we expect him to say. Shekol teluiba. We've seen that lashon before. Again, because we're talking about like the three main baseline mitzvahs of everything else, which is why they're the first three of Rav Hirsch. And again, they come up number 26, number 417 and number 25 so far, not in that order, 25, 417, and 26, according to Sefer HaChinuch, but still, right, like they're basically the basis upon which everything is built. Kol HaModesh B'Avodah Zarah, Kilu Kafar B'Kol HaTorah Kula, exactly again, the same lesson that we've seen again and again from him so far. Okay, and then he talks about, it's the same if you believe in the Avodah Zarah as if you serve it, right, they're both included under this. Okay, and Shoresh, he says exactly what we expect him to say, which is same thing he said for the past two, which is this is blatantly obvious, right? Shoresh mitzvah zo nigla v'yadua. The reason that we have to have this is known, and he doesn't even elaborate at all here. He elaborated in the 25, he elaborated in 417, he's not going to elaborate here. He's like, come on, everyone knows this, we all get it. Doesn't have to go into it, okay? Okay, and then in Prateha, again, and he just goes on basically and says, Kigon Masha Amru, Shaim Kibel Ba'aloha Achir Mikol HaNivraim, Va'afilu Moda. This is interesting, right? He actually goes into like a lot of detail here that he didn't go into in other ones, but he says, even if you take upon yourself a god from all the creations, Afilu Moda Shakarash Baruch Hu Sholei Alav, Va'al Elohu So. If you assume that any creation has power, even if you assume that God has basically like super session power over that god, it still counts over al lo yihia. You're still over on this mitzvah. So like there goes Christianity, right? No, it's not that Jesus was God, it's that Jesus is the son of God, so he's like sort of God, but then God is actually still God over Jesus. That doesn't count. That doesn't count as not Vodazara. It does count as yes, a Vodazara according to Sefer HaChinuch here. Okay, and then he goes into all sorts of things. Says like, you know, umah debra shenikra derech avodaso, like the way that you serve it, and if you serve it in the way that you serve it, or you serve it in the way that it's usual to serve it, even if it's not the way you serve it, and what the difference is between how Jews serve it and how non-Jews serve it, all of that basically is written up in Maseches Avodah Zarah. And he basically refers you there. But he goes on and on and on about all these like kind of different details, which are some of which are really interesting. One of which I'll mention here, which is that he talks about the fact that this is one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, not to do Avodah Zarah. And he pointed out something that I never thought about before, which is that Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the punishment for, the consequence for a non-Jew doing one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, doing one of the things that they're not supposed to do, is always Misa. It's always death. It's always the death penalty. But he points out that Jews have a whole gradient of punishment that we have. Right, we have like, you have to bring a carbon for this, and you have to like, you know, get malchus for this, and then you have kares for this, and you have misa b'shamayim for this, and this, you don't have anything, but you really shouldn't have done it, and you should feel bad about it. And it was really interesting, and I was talking to Jeff about it in the car just now, on our little trip, and he was like, yeah, it's because, you know, we have a chance to do tshuva. It's because a Jew, you're trying to compel them to do tshuva. That was his taich on it. And a non-Jew, it's almost like it's black and white. You either do it, and you deserve to live because of it, or you forfeit your right to that. And there's not really anything in between. It's kind of very black and white. So I just thought that was interesting. Okay. Ready? Rav Hirsch. So let me just make sure we said everything about the chinuch that we wanted to say. Okay. I think so. Let's move on to Rav Hirsch. Okay. Let's take Rav Hirsch's take on this. Again, say Rav Hirsch. Anything surprising? know. We already can expect what he's going to say. We're probably going to expect that from a bunch of the Toros. That, you know, the Shoresh, he's going to say this is blatantly obvious. They don't really have to explain it, which is why it's part of the Toros. It's why it's one of the basic underlying hashkafot mitzvos upon which everything else is founded, especially the mitzvos that Rav Hirsch would have included in the Moriah had he written the Moriah, right? Like the basic foundations of religious belief. Structures, Sefer Chinuch takes them pretty pshat, and he does not feel like he really needs to explain it. He just tells you how important it is. Okay, here we go. Rav Hirsch. Okay, Rav Hirsch is going to take it, obviously, in a different way. Let's see what he does. Okay, Shiduv Avodah Zarah idolatry, right? Our basic question about idolatry that we always have to have underlying this when we're learning about idolatry is like, oh, come on, right? It's cute. I'm going to tell you, like, again, my five-year-old is already, like, very, very determined that we should not bow down to sticks and stones and structures of wood, right? She got it. And she thinks this is a really good idea. We should not do that. And she thinks it's kind of silly that people do, right? So, like, that's kind of the underlying structure around idolatry that we're going to talk about by the time Rav Hirsch is writing in the mid-1800s, right? Which is, like, how do we really relate to this? Like, none of us are tempted to bow down to sticks and stones. So why is this one of the three Yarog V'Yal Yavors? Like, how can we really relate to it today? Okay, that's always going to be the question behind Rav Hirsch, and you're going to see what he does, and he's going to continue it next time, and it's, like, mind-blowing, and I love it every time. Okay, this has, like, a beautiful, beautiful moral at the end of the day here. Okay, here we go. And, like, the last line, but he has a lot of paragraphs before then. We're not probably going to do all of them. Okay, you see, also, I had a problem transferring this from my, I was trying to take, like, a picture of it and then, like, copy the text, and part of it did and part of it didn't, so I just did, like, the last ones now. I finally decided that it was a text, and then the last paragraph, it didn't. My computer didn't. So anyways, you'll forgive the graphic stuff here. Okay. The graphics here. Okay, ready here. I'm going to actually label them 8 so I could talk about paragraph 8, paragraph 9, because that's how it looks like in his book, and it's easier to refer to. Okay, here's this paragraph. As I read it, think about what Rav Hirsch is saying is like the Mila Mancha, right? If you read a set of psukim, oftentimes there's one word that stands out more than any of the other words when you read that as like the theme. Okay, so what's the Mila Mancha in this paragraph? I want you to be thinking about that. And you're going to see that, especially in this introduction paragraph, the first paragraph of idolatry, Rav Hirsch does exactly what he did last time, which is that he tells you, he kind of spells out what the pshat is that you would see otherwise, right? If we weren't taking this for granted, what would we see when we looked around at the world? Remember last time we talked about Achdus Hashem, we're like, Achdus Hashem, of course, there's only one God, that's fine. And Rav Hirsch is like, really? Because when you look around at the world, you don't see Achdus. You don't see one thing. You see many, many opposites coexisting side by side, and Achdus Hashem is actually kind of a chiddush if you think about it. So he's going to do the same kind of thing here. You see, on every side, active forces and their carriers in nature, elements and carriers of elements in the sun and the earth and the sea and the air. In the life of peoples, you see nature, soil, rivers, mountains, and so forth. You see nature, capital N, which is interesting, under the hands of man, raised to a power, and you see men with their wisdom and foolishness, power and weakness, passion and folly, fashioning, destroying and influencing the fate and the life of peoples, and an unseen force that holds sway over destiny and life. And in your own life, you see the spiritual and the animal in you. You see yourself as a creative force, bestowing a blessing or a curse on everything around you. Okay, so what he did there, again, very poetically, it took me a while, I had to do a few tries myself to understand what he was saying. All right, the Mila Mancha here is either power or force. And he's saying, when you look around at the world, you do see things that have massive forces, that seem to have massive amounts of power. If we're talking about, again, in some way, God and Avodah Zarah, and again, it's interesting, he calls it not only Avodah Zarah, but Shituf, right? Shituf means putting something in a partnership with God, making something else equal to God. That's what Avodah Zarah is about for him. And what Rav Hirsch says is that if we just simply, as a simpleton, without thinking about it and without any spiritual structure to guide us, if we just look around at the world, then what we see are lots of things that are extremely powerful. We see nature with a capital N. Again, like Jeff and I watched this like documentary about this group of little like soccer boys in somewhere, Thailand maybe, who got stuck in like the cave. They were like going caving basically, and this like massive tsunami hit. And they show the tsunami, like again, they have like video footage from like days and days and days and days, and then trying to get these kids out. And the massive just force of nature, right? You see tsunamis, you see like any of these videos of like avalanches, right? Like they're insane. You look at just nature itself, it's so powerful. And Rav Hirsch says, like, forget about that. He lists that kind of first, kind of second, kind of last, right? But also, what about people, right? We see people taking so much power into their own hands, ourselves included, right? We see that we do something in the world and it has some sort of effect on the world. If I was thinking as I was like looking, as I was reading this and trying to imagine what he was talking about, like you ever seen those videos of like Hitler? like one man standing on a stage in front of like a like massive crowd of like people who are saluting or cheering for what he's saying, right? There's massive power that we see in the world. We just went to they just created a new United States Military Museum, Army Museum, Museum of the United States Army, something like that, National Museum of the United States Army. And we went to it, and it has all these exhibits of like, again, these like few extremely powerful people making choices that influence the lives of millions of other people, right? And weapons that could take the lives of millions of other people. Actually, at the end here, I have this one of these pictures. It was like an incredible, it was like a memorial to the soldiers lost in World War II. So every one of these guys represents, I don't know, 100, 1,000 soldiers. I don't remember what the exact, probably 1,000, every one of these. And it was like a massive flag made of all these people. Right? And there were choices made by a few extremely powerful people that influences the lives of all these people, all these like little people just seeing it, and all the people that they actually represent, probably 1,000, and all the people that influenced, right? Millions and millions and millions of done out billions of people. It's incredible to think about, right? That's what we see. We look around and we see power everywhere, including in our own selves. Okay, paragraph number 9. But nothing of all this exists or acts by its own power or its own will. Nothing of all this is a god. All of it is created, the servant of the one all-ruling and omnipresent God. In nature, you see God's law hold sway. In the life of peoples, God's providence supreme. In yourself, a strength sent from God. You yourself, as far as your body is concerned, are subject to the laws of nature. You enjoy your moral freedom only as a free and loving gift of the omnipotent. And with that freedom of will, you are called upon to subordinate yourself to the universal law as God's first servant. That much you have learned. Okay, so this is, again, kind of like a transition paragraph where he's basically saying, and again, this is a belief that Rafferty does not explain because he meant to explain it earlier in the Moria, which he did not write, right? But he's saying, you know, we see that these are powers, but we believe that there's something else. That was his basic premise of the previous mitzvah, is that you have to believe that there's a plan, right? There's one plan that unites all of these other forces. So he's saying, you've already learned this, right? We already talked about that. You see all this power, but you believe that there's one, or you should believe, right, in parentheses, you should believe that there's one all-powerful plan and ruling and design above all of them. That much you have learned. Okay, so now he's about to tell us what we haven't learned. What you have learnt, however, you must absorb and take to heart as a part of your life. He said this again and again, right? It's not enough to have learnt that. Here's what it looks like in real life. And this is like probably the main paragraph of this mitzvah. In your actual life, God apart, that probably does not belong there. In your actual life, hold on, let me find that here. In your actual life, you must recognize nothing. Oh man, sorry guys. I'm going to read it from inside, okay? And you're going to read it in here, and hopefully it'll basically line up. What you have learned, however, you must absorb and take to heart as part of your life. In your actual life, you must recognize nothing as God apart from this universal sway of gods. You shall have nothing alongside his omnipresent and all depraving dominion. He just quoted the source passage again. God alone shall be your prop and stay, the guide of your thoughts and feelings, your words and your deeds. Beware then. Here's what he's going to say. This is what, and this is like incredible what Rosh is about to do. We're going to have to backstitch it, okay? He's going to describe what life shouldn't look like, okay? All the other choices that we have. We're like, Avodah Zarah, that doesn't, like, how is that relevant to me? Again, like, what am I going to do, really? Like, what kind of Avodah Zarah am I actually going to do? So he's about to describe it, okay? And he's going to give us actually 10. We're going to go through it, and then we're going to go through it again, okay? There's going to be 10 different potential realities that we have that we could look at that counts as Avodah Zarah in our day and age in the 1850s and now too. Here we go. Okay, beware then, lest you take any creature and, instead of subordinating it to God, place it by the side of God as a deity, or worse still, as your God. He's going to say that again and again. Beware lest, in observing the law of nature and the law which governs the history of mankind, instead of honoring the wisdom of God displayed in them, you place natural law in nature and fate in history, not below God, but alongside God. Or lest you exclude the rule of God from the tiniest corner and introduce blind chance in its place. Beware lest, ignoring the freedom which God has bestowed on you, you misjudge the animal in yourself, and instead of seeing it in it merely a power which has been sent by God and which you yourself can control, you stand in religious awe of it, or lest, overlooking your own limitations, you proudly elevate yourself into a god. Beware lest, instead of building your material life on God alone, you base it on wealth or power or knowledge or cunning or the like. If you do any of these things, you sin against the law. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Okay, so that wasn't only about, like, if you have stone, and if the stone is usually served by, like, pouring something on it, and you pour something on it, you're over it, avodah zarah, and if it's not, but then you bow to it, even if it's usually served by this other way, but then you bow to it, you're still over avodah zarah. Okay, those are all, it's true, those are all halachas of avodah zarah, they're all maseches of avodah zarah, that's fine. Rav Hirsch is talking about the overlying hashkafa that applies even nowadays also to that, despite the fact that none of us are tempted to do any of that stuff ever. Okay, and here's what he's talking about, what are the kinds of temptations that we might place in our own minds and in our own hearts above or on the same plane as God. Okay, here are the 10 that he listed here. Again, I wish I had time to bold it, but I did not. Okay, so if we analyze this paragraph again, if we were in person, I would, in a midrash, I would make you do it, but we're not, so I'm not going to make you do it. Okay, but here are the 10. Ready? Okay, any creature, meaning probably man, because we don't tend to do this with other creature, but any person, if we give any person power, doctors, lawyers, presidents, dictators, right? Anyone power on the same plane as God, that they have any power over us in any capacity, basically, and not just equally subordinate to God, as everything is equally subordinate to God. Not powerful, but still subordinate to God, but actually equally subordinate to God as every other creature in the world. It's kind of like, it's kind of a hard task once we say it like that, isn't it? I mean, to me it is. Okay, two, nature, meaning the laws of nature, meaning science. Does anyone here know anyone who worships the law of science, the laws of science on the same plane as God? I certainly do. The laws of history or fate, right? Whatever it is that guides the patterns of history, Rav Hirsch is very into that. He always puts that nature and history. He always puts them side by side. Okay, so whatever fate might guide history, blind chance. Anyone know anyone who thinks that their lives are guided by blind chance? Like, I know I think I probably could name people who fall into every one of these categories. Okay, this is interesting also. The animal and the self. We're going to talk about this more next time. I have a specific relative who one time said this actually about the next mitzvah, which we're coming up in reverse, is Lo sasur echil v'avcham v'acharei nechem. Okay, so that's the same thing as worshiping. And she said, I don't like that. It implies that, you know, if you're not supposed to, what do you mean sway after your heart? Why are we swaying after our heart? Our heart is like the best guide, right? So this is a very American concept. And this is exactly, right, is putting your animalistic instincts on the same par as God. If my heart tells me I love someone, I love them. What does anything else matter? No moral, like, structure matters. Love is love. Okay, I don't mean to be political here, right? But it doesn't matter. If I want to do something, if my heart and my soul is guiding me somewhere, it's inherently right because I've been guided there, right? That is taking out the structure of something else being on top of that, the something else being called God, right? The animal itself or just the self, right? Just the greatness itself. If you are confused about how great you are, again, you're not aware of your own limitations. Okay, 7 is wealth, 8 is power, 9 is knowledge, 10 is cunning, right? Cunning, politics, manipulation of events. And then he adds an et cetera, which means that he probably could have said more if he had tried. Okay, all of those things, any of those things. We all know people, I think, who hold one of them. And again, let's all call a spade in our own hearts too. In some way, we struggle with this, of not giving power or credence to any of these things other than God. I have one friend, I don't know if I'll name her by name. She's like a real mommin. It's like incredible to me. And at some point I said to her, you know, I sometimes struggle with emunah in as much, I'm not sure if I told you guys this, I feel like I did maybe in the B'tachon Gabura. I was like, sometimes I struggle of like not really knowing if like things that I see, I have a hard time seeing things as Ashkacha, because part of me is like, well, maybe it's not really Ashkacha, and I'm just like thinking that it's Ashkacha. So I'm like, wow, stopped reading for me, but maybe it's not for me, maybe it's like there's a tzaddik on the block and I stopped reading for him. So like, what right do I have to say, like, this happened for me? And she was like, I hear it. So I was like, how do you ever know that anything is like really Ashkacha? And she said to me, I hear you, Chana, but then like, what's the alternative? And if the alternative is any one of these 10 things, or anything else Rav Hirsch might have added, it's a avodah zarah. She didn't say that to me, but that's what it is, right? We have to see things as coming from God, because what's the alternative? If we see anything as not coming from God, this is now a avodah zarah. Like, what is it? It's blind chance? Is it laws of nature? Is it myself? Like, what is there? And if the answer is not God, then we're talking about not the category of avodah zarah, okay? And here Rav Hirsch gets strict. This is probably the most strict we've seen him get with us. Nor is this idolatry merely an error, a mistaking of falsehood for truth. Right? It's not an intellectual mistake. In that case, it would be simply an intellectual mistake, a delusion, deplorable indeed, but even at the worst, not the worst that might happen. Right? You make a mistake. Listen, we all try. We try to think through things. Sometimes we make mistakes. Fine. It's bad, but it's not the worst. For there would still be the human dignity and purity and uprightness of human action, but this is not the case. As soon as you set anything else beside God as God, and still more as your God, that's in italics in his book, forthwith human dignity, purity, and uprightness fall to the ground. The fabric of your life goes to pieces. Right? That is the strictest we've ever seen him go. He's like, you get this wrong. It's not just a mistake. It sounds like a mistake. You're trying to serve God and you serve the wrong thing. Like, oops, you made like an intellectual mistake about like what you're doing. He's like, it's not that. The stakes of this are extremely high, because if we serve anything else as God, all things that make us human fall apart. And he's sort of going to explain it more. And I sort of struggle to try to figure out what he meant by this. And especially this line that he keeps saying, right? As soon as you set anything else beside God as God, and still more as your God, forthwith, everything falls apart. Like, what does he mean, beside God as God, and still more your God? What does he mean, still more your God? And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, listen, again, none of us are struggling. Like, nobody actually nowadays thinks Hitler is God. There's a difference between saying someone thinks Hitler is a God, in which case, like, they're pathological and crazy, and saying what Rav Hirsch means by this line, that someone thinks that Hitler is their God. Right? It's a very different kind of thing. No one thinks that science is God, then you're also insane and don't make any sense. But there are certain people, many of them, who hold science as their God. Right? Meaning they hold by it. They think that it has power over them. And the only way that they could succeed in life or get what they want out of life is working, is serving it, is worshiping it, is working with it. It has the final say in my life. And I am subordinate to it. That's what he means. And in that case, Avodah Zarah is all over the place. There's all sorts of things that we think we have to be subordinate to succeed in life. And that's the problem. As soon as you set anything else beside God as God, and still more as your God, forthwith human dignity, purity, and uprightness fall to the ground. So again, the story that I always think about, which like I'm retrospectively, I'm so happy it happened because I was like so horrified at the time. I'm sure I told you guys this before, but I had one professor in Columbia. I'm going to name him by name. Why shouldn't I? His name is Art Langer. And he one time, Carrie, do you know what story I'm talking about? You're like smiling, right? Like, again, it was like the perfect indication of this, where I'll say it quickly for anyone who does not remember the story, right? But he was like glorifying this fact in class. He was talking about like, you know, mature human thought. The best kind of human thought is human thought that doesn't see things as black and white, but like can think critically. And like the prime example he had of this was when he was driving at night and he came to a stoplight. And he looked around and saw that there was no one there. And he thought to himself, why should I stop at a stoplight if no one's here? I'm just going to follow this red light. And he went through the stoplight. Okay. And this was like his example of like amazing human thought. Like he's a professor in Columbia teaching adults how to teach adults. Okay. That was like his class. And I was like, I cannot believe this story, because what is he actually being ruled by? Right? That is someone to whom, let's say, knowledge is his God. Rationality is his God. As long as I could rationalize why this makes sense, I'm allowed to do whatever I want. But what's he probably actually serving as his God? Himself. He didn't want to wait at that light. So Shkoyach, he built a whole rational philosophy around why it was a great thing that he didn't wait at that light. What's he really serving? His own impatience. And this is exactly it. Like, you could be a professor in Columbia talking about this as if it's like the epitome of human rationality. And actually, all you've done is stunt your own growth as a human being. Because again, you could go through that light. Maybe you can't go through that light, right? But there's higher levels of moral thinking about that. That wasn't moral thinking. It wasn't the best human thinking. The best human thinking would have been something like this. I know I can go through that light because I'm a human and I have my own like koach habechira. Right? But let me think about this. Someone set up this light as a society to keep people safe. And here I am. I don't need to be kept safe, but I'm going to not go through that light as like my tax that I'm paying towards a society that I appreciate has been set up to try. Right? Like, there's all sorts of ways that we could think about that otherwise that would make us into a more developed human being. Or we say like dina demachus adina, right? The law of a government, even though I could rationalize my way out of it, deserves my respect. And so I'm going to stay here. And I'm going to fight my own will to be impatient at this stoplight and not go through it. And who ends up a better human being at the end of the day? Right? This is how religion makes us moral. It's like incredible, exactly this way. And that's what Rav Hirsch says. If you mistake here, it's a big mistake in terms of how you're selling short your own humanity. That's what happens in any of these Toros. It's awesome. Okay. I'm actually going to skip most of this. I'm going to read 12 pretty quickly because he also kind of goes like a little bit in a direction that I don't want to focus on. But his closing line is like astounding. Okay, and then again, the next chabura will go like right into this. It kind of like they're all kind of like linked together at this point, right? Last time for a verse was about a plan, believing that there's one plan, and this is about believing in one God and not putting anything else on top of no one's plan or no one's like capacity to control reality on the same plane as God. Okay, here we go, 12. I want you to hear it all so that you hear it, but we're not going to go into anything probably but the last line. If a man follow, and he's going to go a little bit more into this, by the way, next time he's going to like back reference Avodah Zarah, and we're going to go a little bit more into this, so don't get too bothered by it. And it's awesome. I love it. Okay. If a man follows after any being as God except God, he necessarily sinks to a lower level. That's what we're just talking about. As soon as a man thinks of any being as independent and as belonging only to itself, it must appear to him as tyrannical, right? As soon as something is not controlled by God, then it itself can do whatever it wants, right? It just keeps doing whatever it wants, whether or not it's a creature or a person or self or power or money or whatever, right? It justifies, like self-justifying basically. Intent only on self-aggrandizement and producing only for self-gratification. Again, he's going to go more into this next time. Don't stress out about it. Hence, the man who reveres such beings as God must of necessity regard unbridled violence and self-indulgence not as something bestial and so beneath man, but as something divine and so above man and pursue them as such. Nay, more, when the law of unity has vanished from his conception of the world, that was last time, remember, and the universe breaks apart for him into isolated deities which serve only themselves, right? He suddenly sees a world filled with things that have power and that have power for their own purpose, and then that's it. He will break into all kinds of excess and abandon himself to arrogance and dissoluteness. And if it is only in your material life that you place another god or a human being or yourself by the side or over against God, your course of life inevitably becomes confused. And when you attach yourself to the God of your delusion, you are driven to forsake the God of truth. Inevitably, you will forfeit the vocation of man and an Israelite, right? I like to say now a human being and a Jew, of being a true servant of God, in order to snatch some advantage or to secure your property or to gain the favor of the owner of a property or to indulge in your own fancy, et cetera, right? Or to go through a stoplight at the time that you wanted to. You will of necessity leave God's will out of sight and become either, this is his main line. I would highlight it if I could figure out how to get the text off of this image and onto my paper, okay? And then I would bold it and then I would underline it. It's a beautiful, beautiful line, okay? If you do that, if you give anything power as equal to God or as above you or something that you worship or has any control in your life other than God, what happens? You will of necessity, this is the stakes, this is why it's important, this is the underlying hashgafa. You will of necessity leave God's will out of sight and become either the slave or the idol of your fellow creatures, although you ought to be only their brother, a child like them of the one and only God, man and Israelite, a human being and a Jew. Is that beautiful? That's the problem. Because as soon as we see anything as having power other than God, we are left with only two choices. We have to serve it because it has power over us, or we have to compete with it and get people to serve us. And we become either, and both of these are problematic, we become either the slave or the idol of our fellow creatures. By the way, that's a funny pun, right? The slave or the idol, because they're opposites, but also the idol, that's what he's talking about at Avodah Zarah. You will become either the slave or the idol of your fellow creatures, although you ought to be only their brother. The way that this mitzvah looks, isn't that beautiful? Thanks for smiling about Java, right? Isn't this mitzvah, like, it's so beautiful. The way that this mitzvah looks, if you do it correctly, is that there's massive equality of spirit amongst everybody. You feel amongst all humans and everything else and all of the creatures of God that you are a brother to them and they are a brother to you. And you don't have to serve them and they don't have to serve you. And that's how the world should look. And you cannot get there without only having God as God. So that's this mitzvah. Next time we will do, again, outlook on life. No, just kidding. The world around. Shalilasur, Achrei Leva, Lev V'ayin.